This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Series 8, Episode 2 of Out with Susie Ruffle. Hello. Thank you so much for listening. I'm very excited to be sharing this episode with you. Before we get into that, I want to thank so many of you that got in touch after last week's episode with Liv Hewson, star of Yellow Jackets. If you haven't listened to that yet, I highly recommend it. I loved that conversation and it seemed that loads and loads of you did as well. Today, I've got another really exciting one to share with you, Tig Notaro, who is a stand-up comedian who I'm sure you'll be aware of. I have been a massive fan of hers for years. And I think you'll probably be able to tell that I was quite nervous during this interview, which actually doesn't happen that much. But I think a fellow stand-up and someone that I really look up to, I think you can probably tell that for certainly the first 10 minutes of the conversation, I was feeling very nervous. But hopefully as the conversation wore on, I sounded more like me, hopefully. But yeah, you'll get to listen to that in just a minute. Now, as ever, thank you to all of you that have got in touch with me. As always, I will share a couple of emails before I get into the conversation. And here is a lovely one to start with. Dear Susie, I'm late to your podcast, which seems to be a theme in my life. At 34, I also feel that I'm late to coming out. I've composed this email in my head so many times whilst listening to your podcast, and now that I'm actually trying to write it, my mind is a mess. I think all my life I've known that I'm not straight, wanting to kiss female friends in high school, only having sex dreams about women, or my general obsession with boobs, I think I just pushed those feelings to one side. I had the talk with my mother many times, where she assured me it was okay if I was gay, which I always vehemently denied. During one of the many lockdowns here, a kind doctor worried that I seemed depressed and booked me in with a psychologist. It was here that I was finally able to whisper that I'm bisexual, and I began my journey to accept and open up about my sexuality and believe that I'm worthy of love. I've never been in a proper relationship, and outside of drunken kisses with my friends, I've never kissed a woman. I feel so left behind that I've missed out on so much of my life. I'm not even sure that I'm attracted to men or if it's just the compulsory heterosexuality that I feel. I also think I have a lot of internalized biphobia that I really need to overcome. We're all a work in progress, hey? Listening to other people's stories made me feel less alone. Shock, horror, I'm not a unique, special butterfly who is the only person to come out in their 30s. I'm not sure what the point of this email has been, but it has been therapeutic to put my thoughts on paper. I hope this doesn't mean I have to pay you $200 for the session, though. No, you don't, I promise. Thank you for sharing yours and your guest's story. I think this podcast is so important. And that is from Olivia, who has told me it is okay to use her name. There, you can't get to the party too late. The party's always happening. It doesn't matter. I think that the moment of realization or even acceptance can be different for everyone. And I think, you know, if you've listened to this podcast for a while, you'll know, I think we've mentioned it before, but Jess Foster Q's episode, my dear friend Jess, is a great example of working out things about yourself later in life or changing how you feel about things. And I'm really pleased that this podcast has been therapeutic for you and has been helpful to you. That really means a lot to me. Okay, let's have another one. Dear Susie, I'm extremely late to the party. Another person late to the party. And as a not podcasty kind of person, I've only started listening over the last couple of days. I absolutely adore you as a host. Every episode I've listened to has felt so genuine and warm, and I can only imagine how it must feel for your guests to be able to be so relaxed and so open and have a wonderful safe space to share their stories. I'm writing this off the back of hearing your interview with Mae Martin, who is someone I have admired and loved since I first saw them on telly, and even more so since Taskmaster. which I think you'd be incredible on. Listen, I'd love to do it. And I'm finding it difficult to keep the tears in. Hearing stories of someone who's battled with gender identity, and now I'm finding it difficult to keep the tears in. Hearing stories from someone who's battled with gender identity and how one goes about addressing that feels so close to home for me. I'm non-binary, or at least I think I am. I've not exactly hit the clarity stage yet, and I find it difficult not being androgynous. So never having that question over what gender I was assigned at birth. I'm only out to a handful of people I know in real life and to one relative. I'm still comfortable enough being seen as and referred to as male. And I don't know, I wish it was different. I spent a day in the Edinburgh Fringe this year and wore my progress flag and my pride flag pins for the first time. And while I know they were noticed, I never felt out of place. It was truly one of the best days of my life. Something May said in their interview about parental acceptance really struck a chord with me as well. Whenever my dad was asked if I had a girlfriend, the answer was always, I don't know if he has a girlfriend, a boyfriend or a pet goat, but when he brings them round, I'll make him a cup of tea, which was so big for me growing up. I was advertently and not maliciously outed by an LGBTQIA plus cousin. So now my dad knows that I'm part of the alphabet mafia, but nothing specific. His response always when someone close to him comes out is without words. He just buys them a pair of rainbow laces and wears his own with pride too. I feel like I'm rambling on for far too long, but as I say, you create such a presence of warmth and a welcoming safe place and acceptance and have whenever I've seen you on TV. So again, thank you. Lots of queer love. Now, I'm not going to share your name because you said you went out to everyone and maybe you don't want me to do that. So I'm going to decide not to do that. But thank you so much for the kind things that you've said about the podcast. May's episode is brilliant and I highly recommend you listen to it if you haven't yet. And your dad sounds amazing. Can I just say, your dad sounds awesome. What a great guy. But I'm so pleased that the podcast has felt that to you. And that's exactly what I hoped to do with this podcast. So that really means a lot to me. Okay, let's get on with today's conversation with the brilliant Tig Notaro. Enjoy my slightly nervous energy for the first 10 minutes. I feel slightly embarrassed about it now, but hey ho, what can you do? Here it is, my chat with Tig Notaro. Okay, I'm going to get this out of the way early doors. I am a massive fan of today's guest. Tig Notaro is a Grammy and Emmy nominated comedian, actor and writer, and has been one of my favourite stand-ups for the best part of a decade. I became aware of her when her special Live, a set she performed in a comedy club shortly after finding out she had cancer, went viral. I felt like every stand-up I knew downloaded and watched it immediately. I was utterly blown away by it. Raw, powerful, honest and really funny. She's had a number of brilliant specials since then, and you might have seen her on loads of shows, including Transparent, The Sarah Silverman Show, Star Trek Discovery, and her own shows, One Mississippi and Tig, The Morning Shows, Stephen Colbert and Conan, to name a few. She also has a brilliant book, I'm Just a Person, My Year of Death, Cancer and Epiphany, which I highly recommend. She's also just started a podcast, well, relatively recently, with Fortune Famester and May Martin called Handsome. So have a listen to that as well. She's currently touring Europe and I'm delighted to say she has taken the time to chat to me today. Hello, Tig.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. How are you?
I've been in Amsterdam for 2 days and I'm just now starting to kind of feel like Amsterdam.
Did you come straight from the States?
I did. And yesterday I woke up at 2 a.m. and finished my day with just having gotten up at 2 a.m. So,
oof.
Yeah, but all is fine.
Have you been, I know this is the first bit of your European tour, but have you been touring for a while now, like on the road?
This particular tour, mm-hmm. I have been doing, I feel like it's now 5 years because of the pandemic. I started right before.
Oh, wow.
I think I had been doing this material on the road in the States for, 2 years, maybe a year and a half. I don't know. And then the pandemic, of course, I was home for a couple of years and then I got back out and have been touring. And then the strike, the writers and actors strike happened. And then I was supposed to tape my next special in, I think it was the beginning of summer. Mm-hmm. And then just to be united with everyone, I moved it to November 4th. So I had to add more dates in between the summer and November just to keep myself in it. Yeah. So it's just, I'm excited for November 4th to tape my special and just go home and be done.
Are you the kind of stand-up that once it's taped, you're like, that's done. I never say that stuff again. I'm done with it.
With everything, I would say the majority of it, just because I'm excited to start new things. Mm-hmm. But I also, I always think about how, well, you're familiar with Maria Bamford,
yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah,
she's by far one of my favorites. I think if I was ever at a show and Maria Bamford repeated one of my favorite jokes, I would not be upset.
Yeah.
And I have some material that I revisit when touring, or if somebody asks me to do it, sometimes I'll do. But it's normally that I'm doing my best because I can barely remember material that I've already done and moved on from. So, but I don't have a hard, fast rule, but I feel like I just typically have an ongoing list of material.
That's an exciting play. What I always find, once you finish a tour, I'm just finishing a tour as well at the moment, but the freedom afterwards is quite liberating to be like, oh God, I haven't got to perfect this fucking bit so that it looks good on a video.
Right, right.
How do you tend to put a show together? Do you just sort of do, like, you know, drop in at comedy clubs and try out tens and things like that?
I used to do that more. I would say now I have my home club, Largo in Los Angeles, and venue called Dynasty Typewriter in Los Angeles. And I would say those are the places that I mainly go to, and I'll probably do an hour, hour and a half when I'm in Los Angeles, and just, you know, I'll have a list of things that say, yeah, this isn't actually my material, but like a hotel key or socks or whatever it is.
Oh, the things that are in your hotel room. Yeah.
or whatever is going to jog my memory to remember to tell whatever story or idea that I had. And then I just work it out in real time in front of the audience. But I also, you know, I'm married and I have 2 7-year-olds.
Yep.
And so when I'm home, I typically like to be home, but it's nice that I can do shows after my kids go to bed. Yeah. So I don't do it like I used to do it before, where I was 5 to 7 nights a week going club to club. I just don't do it.
At what year did you start? Because obviously, as I mentioned in the intro, like, I became aware of you when the special live went like viral.
It's actually called Live.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No, I named it that so people would...
So people would do that?
Do that. Because, you know, that's a typical name for an album is the person
course.
Or the band's name and then live.
Yeah.
But because I was so ill at the time, I thought it would be good to call it Live. But I have been doing stand-up, I think, since 96.
Oh, wow.
Gosh, almost 28 years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long old time, because you were, before that special came out, I know that you were already sort of having like a real year of like working loads and doing loads of stuff. So I was wondering if we could go like back even further, right to the beginning kind of thing. Like, I know that you were born in Mississippi and then you grew up in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've got loads of listeners, well, from all over the world, actually, but lots of European listeners. What would that have looked like at that point in what, like the 70s? What did Texas feel like at that point when you were sort of a young person there?
I mean, I met some of my closest friends of my life there, mm-hmm. and they're still my closest friends. It was just a lot of outside playing as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
It also felt pretty inconsistent. My life, you know, my stepfather traveled a lot and my mother partied a lot, and my father wasn't in my life consistently at all. So it was a real mix of probably a typical childhood and then also what the hell's going on? This in my life, but I mean, Texas in the 70s, I don't really know what was going on in Texas in the 70s. I didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
You know, I was just a really young kid.
Were you the kind of kid to be like, were you funny as a kid? Were you trying to be funny?
Yeah, it was very much my go-to. I was the class clown, mm-hmm. and my mother was a very funny, gregarious, wild person, and mm-hmm. She influenced me, but I had a different delivery and style to my comedy. I was way, way drier.
Yeah.
And my stepfather, he was funny too. He was just a very buttoned up, dry, funny. And, but yeah, I was no doubt in trouble, making jokes, doing all sorts of things, pranks. And yeah, I feel like school was my, my college for becoming a stand-up.
Your apprenticeship.
Yeah.
And when you were being that sort of funny person, maybe when you were in high school, how aware of your sexuality were you? Did you feel sort of other, for want of a better word?
Yeah, I guess I felt different than a lot of my friends. But then some of those friends actually ended up dating women. But I felt like I was definitely different than the majority of people in my school. And I didn't know what it was. Mm. I wasn't aware of my sexuality at all, probably until I was 19.
So would it have just been like I guess I'm just a bit different to other people?
Yeah, but also to myself.
Right.
I guess because I couldn't figure out why I was different to other people, so I just felt just different in mm-hmm. in general. And then I thought, well, I thought of myself as a tomboy. I thought of myself as a funny person. I played sports. I was an artist. I didn't seem to have exactly the same interests as some of the other girls that I was around or friends with. But I was like, well, I guess I'm just different.
And do you think that that was because of a sort of lack of representation of people like us? Is it because you didn't see anyone?
Oh, it had to have been. But then when I was in high school, the vice principal of my school, she took a liking to me and expressed care and concern for what I was up to. And I wasn't just in trouble when I would see her. It was that she just became kind of a guide in my life. And then I realized, oh, she's gay.
Right.
My mother said it to me. My mother said, do you think she's gay? And I said, I don't know. I don't think so. Like, it never had crossed my mind.
Right.
And my mother said, I think she is. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. And now I know she is, and I'm still in touch with her.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, yeah. When I came out to her, and then she came out to me, I let her know.
That's nice. I had a teacher like that. I've never found out, but I'm pretty sure one of my science teachers was gay. That, or she was just a straight woman that loved trousers with lots of pockets.
Smart woman.
Listen, who doesn't need a pocket, right? But I used to follow her around, mm-hmm. and I think she knew when we would chat, and she would be like, okay, goodbye, Susie. And I'd be like, okay, bye.
Yeah.
I just liked being sort of somewhere, even though I didn't really have the vocabulary.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't really know the thing.
Yeah.
But I was like, I want to stand near you.
Yes.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
I know that you worked in the music industry for a while.
Yeah.
And then at what point were you like, I'm going to take this to comedy?
Well, I was living in Denver with the childhood friend. I had a couple of childhood friends that I was very close to that I had talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. And they were moving to Los Angeles to work in TV and film. And I had gone through a breakup in Denver. And I thought, well, since that's over, maybe I'll just come with you. And so I packed up my things and threw them in the truck and went to Los Angeles with them with the intention of returning to Colorado in like 6 months after the smoke cleared. And but once I got to LA, I saw all of the opportunity to do stand-up at clubs and bars and coffee shops and everywhere. I just started trying stand-up because it had always been the thing that I dreamed of doing, but I never imagined I would actually try.
Who were the stand-ups that you were watching when you were growing up to be sort of inspired by?
I loved Stephen Wright and Steve Martin and Ellen and Rosie O'Donnell, Joan Rivers, Richard Pryor. Those were the main ones, but I watched everything I could get my hands on.
And what was it like? Well, two questions, really. What was it like as a woman in that point in the 90s in LA doing stand-up? But what was it like as a gay woman?
Well, the first time I did stand-up was at a gay coffee shop. And so it was very inclusive and I personally didn't notice any sort of issues or trouble with getting on stage anywhere, but you know, it might have just been that because it's very weird to say that being gay, I know some people felt like being gay held them back, whereas I felt like being gay helped me. I felt, because when I would hear from straight women that they felt like they couldn't get stage time, I wasn't really experiencing that. And if I was experiencing it, I didn't really know I was experiencing it. I just didn't even think about it. I just thought, oh, they don't want me on this show, and then I'll move on to the next one, and then I get on the next show, or I don't fit in this lineup, or I don't know. I really didn't think about it.
I guess that there was because of, I guess, people like having seen Ellen and Rosie O'Donnell, you sort of knew it was possible for there to be such successful women. But I think I've found that quite often people would like to have someone different on the bill to just be like, oh, there's another option. I guess that's I've found that as well. And so there was obviously, you know, well, way more than a decade of you sort of gigging around, sort of finding your voice. Mm-hmm. Was that something that came to you quite naturally? The sort of, I mean, you know your style, but for listeners, like, you know, you're quite slow, you're quite measured, you're very, I don't know how much you like the word deadpan, I know some people don't like it, but there's a measuredness to you on stage. Was that something that took a while to find, or were you naturally that person?
Well, I think I'm naturally that person, but I'm also, I think like most people, different in different scenarios. And mm-hmm. it's just all based on my comfort level with mm-hmm. whether I'm one-on-one with somebody or in a small group or on stage. But I don't think it's a huge stretch from my typical delivery, mm-hmm. but I don't know. I started out much slower when I was first starting out.
Really?
Well, yeah, like I used to be very just set up punchline, mm-hmm. very dry and slow. Whereas now I think I'm more conversational and, mm-hmm. you know, as we've mentioned, I've been doing it almost 30 years. So it's the bones are still there of what originally, started on stage, but I just am more conversational, and I would mm-hmm. say not as slow, and I'm still slow and dry, but yeah.
I think that's really interesting because I think being slow on stage is really brave. Mm. And so it's interesting that you were always sort of, no, this is what I do. That's impressive.
Well, I think it's just like doing comedy anyway. It's, you know, when people say, oh my gosh, it's so brave, or that's so scary, public speaking or comedy. But, you know, when it's what you are naturally drawn to or what your strength is, it doesn't feel brave at all. It just mm-hmm. feels like this is what I do. And I always think mm-hmm. it, you know, if somebody said, no, you have to, the doctor passed out, we need you to come in here and finish the surgery. If I did that, that would be tremendously brave.
Yes.
But if I'm going on stage telling you something crazy my kid said, it doesn't feel even remotely brave.
Yeah. No, I get what you mean.
Yeah.
I get what you mean. So I know that you've said before in interviews and also from reading and watching a lot of your work that you, after your special Live, which I will never get wrong again, came out, that you, is it fair to say that you sort of became more honest on stage and you were sort of more up for sharing more of yourself?
Yeah, definitely. I think it just became part of the mix of what I was going to do on stage. It was a confusing time because after being really sick and losing my mother and my girlfriend and all of that, and sharing all of my turmoil and making it, you know, making light of it on stage, I was getting so much attention for that I was kind of confused, like what my style was, what I wanted to say beyond that show that I did, the Live show. Mm-hmm. So it took me, I don't know, a year or two or something, I can't remember, but to really realize that, yeah, I love that I was able to share and make jokes and tell stories about that hard time in my life, but I also really love utter nonsense. Mm-hmm. That's not dark, that's not truth telling, that's just stupid. I just mm-hmm. love ridiculousness.
Yeah.
So it's been a process of, it's like I was saying, how I would just do set up punchline, very dry in the early days. Now I'm more conversational. So it's like, you know, as you go along in life, you just gather more and more things, elements, personality traits, whatever way that you shift or change that you bring along with you. It's similar, I think, what I went through on stage as a comedian. I just allowed myself to grow and try out new things that I felt like doing, and not, you know, there's so many comedians that once they have their stage persona or their way that they do things, they stay with that, and that is the mm-hmm. end of the story, and then they paint themselves into a corner. And I had moments where I would struggle and think, well, I want to try something different, or this isn't really my, you know, mm-hmm. my style anymore, or there's something else that maybe I'll do. And I would struggle in my head and heart over it. And then I would think, if a friend of mine, a fellow comedian, said, hey, Tig, what do you think? I was thinking of trying this. It's not really my typical style. Should I do it? I would never say, no, don't try anything new. Mm. You know?
Yeah.
I would never tell anyone that. So why am I telling myself that? And so I just began to, you know, allow myself to shift and change.
And then you were sort of even more open in the show for Netflix, Tig, which is about you and your wife trying to get pregnant. I mean, that really was wide open for the world to mm-hmm. see. How much did you sort of have to consider how much you were going to share about that journey?
Well, I didn't know the journey I was on.
Right, of course.
And yeah, of course. That's the crazy thing about a documentary, is once you've seen the movie, you kind of forget, just as you don't know what your life is going to be in the next year. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what that movie was going to be. I honestly thought, because I had gotten out of the hospital and I felt like I was on the mend in life, this is crazy to say, but I really thought there was nothing else that could go wrong in my life. And so when I was approached about doing this documentary about my life, I thought, sure, yeah, you can film my victory lap.
Right.
And then as it was going on and things were unfolding, I was realizing, oh no, this is life. It's not just smooth sailing from here. And so the movie was capturing, there were five main storylines. I was falling in love. I was mm-hmm. getting back on stage as a comedian. I was trying to have a child. I can't even remember. There were so many things going on, and none of them were easy to say the least. So I didn't know what was coming. And as things were unfolding, I remember thinking, okay, I'm already nearly a year into filming this movie, you know, when I was trying to have the child. And, and I don't know why, after everything that had happened to me, that I was still so, I was thinking so positively about everything. And then again, it never dawned on me that anything could go awry. It's so embarrassing. but I somehow didn't account for the fact that the camera was going to be catching me in these moments. But when it did, I just thought, okay, I've got to just let this happen, because if I'm going to put out a documentary, which I've already agreed to do and put so much time and effort in, then there's no point in releasing a movie that doesn't have any depth to it, because I mean, I love documentaries, and that's the kind you want to see, is all the twists and turns that you don't expect.
Yeah. Absolutely. Did it feel exposing when it came out?
Oh my gosh. Yes. And also the film, it wasn't quite what it is now and what came out. There was a lot of back and forth and struggle with the story, because
right.
I think they did ultimately an excellent job, but there were just so many stories to manage and so there were different iterations of the film that didn't see the light of day, that I just thought, well, this isn't right. And so we continued to work on it.
I mean, after you share like that kind of story with the world, now on stage, you must be like, oh, fuck, I'll tell you anything. it must feel, I don't know, quite liberating. Is that
it is
fair?
It is. Yeah, it's liberating, but it's also, it was a lesson of, as much as I share, I don't share everything.
Of course.
And so that's the balance and the lesson of, okay, it feels really nice to be open and honest and as authentic as possible. But, you know, getting married, having kids, and even though I'm now in remission, I've still had a real roller coaster of health issues over the past decade. And so there's things that I share and things I don't share. And that was just the... It was a good lesson to learn because, you know, people being as honest and open as I have been on stage, people assume they're getting all of the information and all of the story of my life, but you're not.
You got to save some.
I do.
Do you go to your partner, do you go to Stephanie and say, is this like, do you have like a person that you check with or a barometer for yourself to go, oh no, that's far too much? Or do you just know it instinctively?
I know some instinctively, but before I was with Stephanie, I didn't really think about anybody in that way. Mm-hmm. I just had my material and shared it and then went home. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had girlfriends, of course, but I just wasn't as committed to the relationship. And I think after being with Stephanie, she started to say things like, which I appreciate now. And at the time I was like, wait, what? You know, because she would say, oh, I don't know if you should talk about that. Or, oh, that's my thing. Or I don't think our kids... you know, that they're not old enough to agree to that. Or and I was like, oh right, she's right. And I know a lot of people will say, this is my better half or my spouse is smarter than me, but oh my God, is Stephanie smarter than me? It is alarming, and I never get over it. Ever.
That's nice.
Yeah. It's true.
It's really nice.
It's true.
Yeah, but it's lovely. My wife and I have a child as well. And Alice often says to me, she's like, I don't know if she'll thank you for that in years to come. And I'm like, okay. Okay, I won't do that bit. Okay. I think it's fun. She's like, I think that's more sort of funny for our friends.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay. And that's it's good to have a person that's that cares in a different way.
How old is your child?
She is 3.
Oh, nice.
She's 3. So we're in the midst of, you know, a lot of feelings. I wanted a feminist, but not this quick.
Yeah.
She's big emotions.
That's great.
But, I mean, the greatest thing that's ever happened to me.
That's amazing.
But, you know, it's a juggle, isn't it? Being a parent that's touring.
Yes, it really is. And then also, you know, on this tour, I've probably done over 100 shows. It'll be way more than that after I finish in November, but I'm home the rest of the time. And and there are times when I'm filming TV or movies, but in general, when I'm home, I'm home, and then I'll go into my office and record my podcast.
Yeah.
And I also have the real luxury of Stephanie being just, I mean, she works and is busy too, but we always marvel over how somehow we have a balance. I mean, her father lives in Los Angeles and is our babysitter or whatever you want to nanny. Mm-hmm. That's who hangs out with our sons. I don't know if I mentioned there's 7. Mm-hmm. So they're usually at school, or we go to their friends' houses, or they're home with us, or their grandfather, and they have a very, very consistent schedule and life.
Yeah.
And they're both just thriving and happy and hilarious.
And you said hilarious as I was asking.
Yeah. Well, I would say our son Finn is hilarious in his own way of his personality. He's kind of like a type A. His whole life he's been very, he likes to check sports stats. He lives by the clock, and he tells his brother, you know, it's time, we need to go up, it's time for bed, or, you know, he's you know, or like, Max, hurry, we're late for school, we gotta get going. And so he's just so funny in that way, where we cannot believe what a little man he is.
Yeah.
And then our son Max, I always say he was born 60 years old. If you think I'm dry, he is. He loves words. He loves stories. He loves songs. He loves Bob Dylan. He loves to know what is Bob Dylan talking about? What is the story of this song? He loves jokes. Oh, wow. He loves puns. We were in Colorado last October, and I was driving, and the two of them were in the back seat, and Stephanie and I are up front, and I said, "Oh my God, there's a pumpkin in the road. Somebody had smashed a pumpkin." And Max, sitting in his little car seat, so dry, he said, "You mean, oh my gourd?" He said,
"That's good."
Yeah, I know. He said, "Pumpkins are gourds." Stephanie and I looked at each other, and then I looked back at him and I said, "What did you just say?" And he said, "You mean, oh my gourd, pumpkins are gourds." And I was like, this is hilarious. And
that's
then
really funny.
This is the last thing I'll say about if they're funny, but we have three cats, and it was me, Stephanie, Max, Finn, their grandfather, and our three cats sitting on the couch watching a movie. And when Max was four, he got up and just said, "All right, I'm gonna get the hell out of here. All these damn cats."
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. So we're endlessly amused by them. I keep this ongoing document of everything, not everything they say, but God, close to. It goes for pages.
Yeah. The other day I was walking her home from nursery. She was in her little stroller, and I accidentally clipped the curb.
Mm-hmm.
And she had spent the week before with my mum, who sort of speaks in a very sort of British working class way.
Uh-huh.
And I clipped the road, and my daughter turned around to me and went, "All right, love, easy." And I just said, "Oh, you've been with Nanny. You've spent so much time with Nanny. Easy." Just hilarious.
That's so funny.
It's great, isn't it? Yeah. Endlessly entertaining. Now, I'm well aware that you need to check out of a hotel room, so I'm going to ask you one more question very quickly, and then we're done. It's the final question I ask always on this show, because lots of people write in asking for advice, which I don't feel like I'm qualified to give, but I like to ask my guests if you could sort of reach out to someone that's maybe going through something that has been similar to you. And I know, like, I don't want to go into your sort of health complications, and because I imagine that's all very stressful and awful to go into, obviously. But I'm sort of thinking of a version of you, maybe before you had sort of the success that you have now, maybe before you had, you know, the kind of relationship that you have now, which sounds incredible, and the family that you have now. If they were hoping to get that at some point, but they were still in a point where it felt like they were, I don't know, there was no light at the end of the tunnel. If you could reach out to them and just give them a few words of encouragement, what would you say?
Well, I think that I always marvel when I'll be in conversation with Stephanie or anybody really, and talking about hard times or what seems like wrong turns in life, and those moments where the door is about to close and you got through the door of life, you know, in those moments where you're like, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe I made it through that." Well, even if it's not cancer or a deadly illness, it's just, or even like, "Oh gosh, I'm so glad I made that decision." When my childhood friends were moving to Los Angeles, I didn't know Stephanie and Max and Finn and our life. I didn't know they were out there. But I'm always like, "Oh gosh, I I can't believe I made it through. I can't believe I got through that door before it shut. And yeah, and when I look at Stephanie and Max and Finn, I do, and I know people talk about this all the time, but all of the seemingly wrong and bad turns and decisions and hard times are leading you to that other side, and to just have faith and to trust life. And that even means, that means all of the good and all of the bad. You just have to trust life. But I think it also has to be very driven by earnest, authentic, connected decisions of your own. And that's all you can do. And that's all I've ever done. And a lot of what I've done has been huge leaps. And that worked for me, but that's again trusting life.
Oh, that was perfect. Thank you, Tig. That was the brilliant Tig Notaro. Check out the podcast, and if you've got tickets to go and see them, I'm pretty sure it's all sold out. Have a brilliant time. I'll be back with you next week. Until then, take care. Bye.